that doozy of a parable with a couple of feel-good clips from YouTube. On screen one, we see an unlikely and heartwarming adoption as a tiger nurses abandoned piglets. I'm not making this up. On screen two, we see high school student Megan Vogel as she stops running in the state track meet to help a competitor who had collapsed cross the finish line ahead of her. And now, screen three, front and center. We see people sharing coats and food and care. We see the good shepherd leaving the 99 to go after that one lost sheep. We see the prodigal son being welcomed back with extravagance. You know, the teachings of Jesus that we like. But today we have a different parable. So, what gives? No second chances? Just be wise and look out for number one? Surely there must have been another way. Stop being so greedy, you wise bridesmaids. I want to yell. That may be true. And I don't think this parable is actually about sharing. Backing up a little, some context. Matthew's gospel comes into being in a community still defining itself. They, like those supposedly foolish bridesmaids, are having doors slammed in their faces. They remain Jewish, but they hold an increasingly different set of priorities. And as they welcome more Gentiles in without requiring full adherence to the law, they are receiving pushback. And they are struggling on the inside, competing with people that they experience as frightening false prophets. They are weathering internal strife as they discern who exactly they are. And then we have the context of the parable itself. A wedding. Again, Jesus loves these, right? He ensures that there is plenty of excellent wine at Cana. He tells stories about the challenge of convincing people to show up for the wedding banquet and to come in style. And now, these bridesmaids. Why? Why all these weddings? Well, there exists a funny sort of Venn diagram at weddings. In one circle, we have the seriousness of making a huge commitment. Right? So it's obvious for the bride and groom, but it applies to everyone. Parents and siblings are committing to a new way of being family. The whole community promises to uphold the couple and their vows. Serious commitment. And then, in the other circle, over here, we have the party. Sumptuous feasting, friends reunited, hopefully great music, but even a mediocre DJ should be able to get the people dancing. Such weighty promises and such lighthearted revelry, they don't often overlap, but they do at a wedding. And that sweet spot, that sliver in the middle of the Venn diagram, that's where we are called to engage. Deep vows, over-the-top celebration. The timing makes it yet trickier. We're asked to stay awake, and yet it's fine for the bridesmaids to sleep. Be ready for anything. And all those end-time predictions have failed so far. Let's get comfortable and be a while. Mixed messages. What connects them is the frustrating mystery that time operates differently with God. It's not necessarily linear. Something we can calculate or anticipate. Closeness with God can come in a thin place, those spots where the distance between heaven and earth collapse in. And this connection also comes at thin time. being open to God often means letting go of carefully made plans and wandering into that thin space, that liminal time where God is already here and yet still bursting in on the scene, where God has created and yet is still transforming. But what does that mean in this era of instantly synced calendars designed to help us keep entirely too many balls in the air? Perhaps it's about learning to show up with a more expansive stance, ready to be surprised, but also prepared to sit back together, to be patient as this wild kingdom of heaven unfolds while we're still just making the hors d'oeuvres for the party, but choosing it and showing up. And then, can we turn to Joshua's speech of reverse psychology? As the parent of a toddler, I totally relate. The people see how God has blessed them, even on this wild goose hunt towards liberation, and they want to come closer. They want to choose God, serve God, have that define their home. Surely, Joshua wants this as well. But he also knows how hard it is. He doesn't want them to make this choice lightly, and so he pushes them. No, this can't really be what you want. I don't think you're up to it. Really? You're promising again? A third time? All right, let's do this. It's not a choice you make once. It's a slowing down, a looking up, choosing the holy daily, many times daily, and over months and years, reaching out repeatedly and receiving that beckoning invitation repeatedly, and making friends with the discomfort of being surprised. Because while we have some guesses as to how and when we might come near, God is also a surprising trickster, a wild partier who's hard to pin down. And back to this aggravating parable. I have my complaints, but I'm not ready to throw it out yet. I do wish the so-called wise bridesmaids had shared their oil. If they were so brilliant, surely they could have solved the literal problem at hand, huddling together in the light of their own lamps, or letting the others in the back door, or something. But maybe that's not the point today. Maybe this parable is the wake-up call that following Jesus can't be put off, and it takes time. At the end of the day, and especially in the middle of the night, coming close to God, showing up for the party, this isn't something that anyone else can do for us. We can walk this path together. We can practice and reflect and sing and party together. But what we do in our hearts is actually up to us as individuals. And sometimes the wake-up calls sting. Sometimes we get confused about what matters, and we do miss the party. Just the other evening, I was out for a walk up in these hills with my family. Jesse and I were lost in what I'm sure was a conversation of deep import, and we were not paying attention to Alice. And after several more subtle attempts, she finally exclaimed, Excuse me, but would you please pay attention to me, both of you, at the same time? Called to task by the clarity of a three-year-old. We both burst out laughing, and we shifted our focus. And in the days since, I've been wondering what else is demanding our full, engaged attention. So often this parable is used to depict the final judgment, a fearful reckoning of who's in and who's out. But these images of the eschaton, the end times, they aren't just one community's prediction of what will happen when it's all said and done. These images are also a commentary on our present piercing observations of how we live right now. Based on the totality of the gospel, simply don't believe that anyone who seeks God will be definitively shut of the party. That doesn't follow from the rest of what Jesus teaches. The good shepherd goes to the end to find that one lost sheep. The father welcomes that wayward son home by pulling out all the stops. And as Paul writes in our epistle, even the dead are not beyond the reach of Christ's love. But when we fail to choose God, when we fail to be present with our whole selves, ready to engage for the long haul, the reality is that we do miss out. And sometimes when we realize it, it's already too late for that particular party. I don't believe this is a lasting condemnation, but a wake-up call to step into that thin place, that sliver in the Venn diagram where commitment and revelry illumine one another. Because while there will be more invitations, more parties, more openings into the nearness of God, none of them really matter. We don't start responding for ourselves and joining the dance. And so, as we look ahead, let us cast aside our excuses, our fears of not having enough oil, or whatever it is we think we need first. And just come, commit, celebrate. Instead of shrinking away from a door once closed, let's gather our gumption, our resolve,